Wake up, America. Time to stump the experts. Each week at this time, the H.J. Heinz Company, makers of the famous 57 varieties, gives you information, please. A quartet of experts is on hand to answer your questions. Send them to Information, Please, at 570 Lexington Avenue, New York City. We may edit them a bit, and in case of similarity, you'll have to accept our judgment of who shall be paid. If we use your question, the H.J. Heinz Company will send $10 in war stamps, plus a set of the 12-volume Britannica Junior Encyclopedia. If we muff the question, you get $57 in war bonds and stamps, plus a 24-volume set of the regular Encyclopedia Britannica. All questions remain our property. Information, Please, is presented under the supervision of Dan Goldenpohl. And now, our master of ceremonies, book reviewer of the New Yorker magazine, Clifton Fadiman.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Ladies and gentlemen, unpredictable and spontaneous as ever, Information, Please, tonight offers its two end men, John Kieran of the New York Sun and Franklin P. Adams, together with our good friend, the famous writer Christopher Morley, whose most recent book is Thoroughfare, and the distinguished scholar and dean of Vassar College, not necessarily exclusive, of course, Dr. C. Mildred Thompson. Next week, by the way, we'll be broadcasting from Chicago, which, with typical Midwestern energy, is rolling up a huge bond sale in anticipation of our visit. We ask our audience to listen with extra care to our announcement at the end of the program. The name of our guest will be of special interest to all of us, and we think particularly to Chicago. We're going to begin with an interesting question that comes to us from Lillian Scheckman of East Orange, New Jersey. Name these men who fought for another country beside our own. I'll describe them to you. Let's get two out of three. This one fought for democracy in Prussia in 1848 and became a general in the Civil War here also. Miss Thompson.
I think that was Schurz.
Yes,
Carl Schurz.
That's right. When did he fight for democracy in Germany? It seems a long time
ago. Well, he was in 1848 in the liberal movement there.
Yes.
He escaped from his persecutors and came to this country and took part immediately in political life here.
Yes.
Became a
Germany
liberal
lost
leader.
Germany lost her shirts in 1848 and is going to lose it in 1943, too.
I hope so.
I think he also helped Joseph Pulitzer found the Post Dispatch in St. Louis.
I think that's true. And wasn't there another famous German emigre, Dean Thompson, of that period, who also fought in the
yes,
United States?
Yes, and his statue's down here on Riverside Drive.
That's right.
I can't think of his name at this moment.
We should remember. We should remember the Germans who came over here.
It's right next to the Fireman's Memorial there.
It's Franz Siegel.
That's
Franz Siegel. Less well-known, perhaps, than Carl Schurz. How about this one? This man commanded ships for our country, and also for the ruler of Russia. Who was that? Mr. Kieran.
John Paul Jones.
John Paul Jones, yes. Fought in what war here?
Revolution.
And how about what other country did he... In what other war did he fight for another country? For Russia, in this case. Whom did he serve under?
He served under the Tsar.
Well, she wasn't a Tsar.
Catherine.
Yes, the Empress of Catherine in a war with Turkey that Russia was carrying on at that time. This one fought first for the British and then the United States in World War I, and did the same in the present war. Who was that? We should know that name. Mr. Kieran.
Well, for one, the late Major Kermit Roosevelt.
Yes. That was one I was thinking of, who died recently, we were all very sorry to hear, in Alaska. Was there another one, Mr. Kieran?
That's the only one that
I would be familiar with. How about this? From Irma Ruff of El Paso, Texas. Can you recite for us some lines of poetry that include these words? They all have to do with talking. The first is, quote, talk of many things, close quote. Mr. Adams.
Time has come, the walrus said.
That's the
talk
one.
Of many things.
Right. And you'll find it where, Mr. Adams?
You'll find it in, I think it's in Through the Looking Glass, but it may be in Alice's Adventures in Wonderland.
Anybody want to settle that?
I think it's in, he's right, it's in Through the Looking Glass.
It's very nice to hear you fellows agreeing. Unusual, but pleasant. That's the first bit of talk. Now, how about this, quote, talk of graves, close quote. Talk of graves. Mr. Kieran.
Let's talk of graves and epitaphs and worms. That's King Richard II. For God's sake, let's sit upon the ground and tell sad stories of the death of kings.
Yes, the beautiful lines. What act does it come from, Mr. Kieran?
That would be an act that's toward the end of the play, Act 4 or 5, whichever it is.
I think it's Act 2.
Richard the Second?
No, am I wrong?
Oh, I think it's later than that, but I... You've got the book. I'm not going to argue.
Bedham, you think, Adams? Good way to lose a quarter. I'll look it up when I get home. Talking about heaven. Mr. Adams.
All God's children got wings.
Shoes.
Shoes.
Shoes, yes. Right.
Make it something really precious, Mr. Yeah. Adams. Yes, all God's children got shoes.
Well, wings are still not rationed.
No, not rationed. But they're a very poor substitute. Well, we have still to stump you people. Barbara Burke of New York City sends this one in. Suppose I give you the names of two famous adversaries that were defeated by a famous man, even more famous than they were. Name the man in each case. For example, Tecumseh and Van Buren were both defeated by the same person. Which person was that? Tecumseh and Van Buren. Mr. Kieran?
William Henry Harrison.
Yes, who was Tecumseh?
President of the United States for a very short time because he was overtaken by a fatal illness.
Yes, very elegantly put. Tell us about a little about...
He was elected on the slogan, Tippecanoe and Tyler Too.
I know about Tecumseh.
Oh, well, he was an Indian chief. Right. And he raised a row, and they sent out William Henry Harrison after him. And he beat him down that time, but he escaped and caused more trouble later, as a matter of fact.
Good enough. And who? What was the election which Van Buren...
That was the election of 1841.
1841 is right. Now, how about Pemberton and Greeley? They were both defeated by the same man. Pemberton and Greeley were both defeated, Mr. Adams, by whom?
Defeated by Abraham Lincoln.
Now, that couldn't be wronger, I don't think. But let's see what sort of case you can make out for it. And that's what I'm interested in, Mr. Adams. I bet he can prove it.
No, there weren't either.
Mr. Thompson?
Well, Greeley, I know, was defeated by Grant in 1872.
That's right. And how about... And Pemberton was also defeated
by
Grant.
Well, I would just...
Yes, who was Pemberton?
I really don't think he was.
The Civil War.
Yes.
General Pemberton. Confederate side.
Yes. We'll forget that you said Abraham Lincoln, if that's all right with you, Mr. Adams. It's going to take time to forget it, but we're going to try. I have to count that one wrong. Now, how about Pakenham and Clay were both defeated by the same famous man? Pakenham and Clay. These are all from Mr. Adams?
Andrew Jackson.
That's absolutely right, Mr. Adams. Tell us a little about Pakenham.
About Pakenham.
How about Clay?
Henry Clay was a bitter enemy of Andrew Jackson.
Yeah, and in what battle? What was the occasion of that disagreement, Mr. Kieran?
Well,
the bank.
The secessionist movement
right.
was raising its ugly head, and Clay was a perennial candidate.
Yes, he was the Bryan of his day.
He finally wound up saying he'd rather be right, and he wasn't even that all the time.
No. Well, now we have Clay, who was defeated by Jackson in the election of 1832. But who was Pakenham? We ought to try to get Mr. Pakenham straight. Pakenham was the general against whom Andrew Jackson fought at the Battle of New Orleans.
That's right.
We all should know that. Miss Thompson, it seems to me you should have known that as well.
On January 8th.
January 8th. And what's funny about the date, Mr. Adams? Well, why do we remember that?
Because that's the day they have the Jackson Day dinners.
That's one way, yes. I wasn't thinking of that $10
Battle of New Orleans, January 8th.
Mr. Kieran, is there any other reason
Three
for
Three weeks after the signing of the Treaty of Ghent, I believe.
Yes, owing to the slow...
War was over, but they hadn't heard
over.
About it.
That's right. That gives us 2 out of 3. Try this one. Here's a literary question from Jane Ringo of Ironton, Missouri. In what books... This is a good question. In what books are these chapter headings found? I'll just give you the chapter heading. You've got to give me the book. This is a tough one. The first chapter heading is Tragedy in the Graveyard. Tragedy in the Graveyard. Mr. Adams?
That's by Mark Twain.
Mr. Morley, what were you going to say?
I was going to say Uncle Tom's Cabin.
That would have been wrong. That would have been wrong. It's a good thing I called on Adams first. Which of the Mark Twain books were you going to say it was from?
I think it's from Huckleberry Finn.
Well, there you go, spoiling everything. It's Tom Sawyer. It's Tom Sawyer. There's a famous scene in the
Engine
graveyard.
Joe.
Yes. Remember, you all remember the famous scene now. Mr. Morley, back to you. What made you say Uncle Tom's Cabin?
I had a vision of a dark figure in the graveyard.
There's the novelist.
No, that's on the ice.
I don't think we can give you perfect credit on that, Frank.
No.
Now, here's another chapter heading. The Spouter Inn. The Spouter Inn, Mr. Morley.
That's Moby Dick.
No doubt about that. Moby Dick. What chapter about would that be?
Well, it's very early. It's up in New Bedford, about the third or fourth chapter, I should think.
Yes. Isn't that the place where the hero of the book encounters the...
Where he meets Queequeg and the other whalers.
Right. Now, here's another chapter heading. Little Sisters Have Big Ears. What's it from? Little Sisters Have Big Ears. Not a bad gag, Mr. Morley.
Is it all right to...
Guess?
Okay. Guess again? I would say Louisa M. Alcott.
That's an interesting guess. Now, why do you say that?
Well, I think of Little Women.
Little Sisters Have Big Ears. You know, it sounds very convinced. Wrong, but it sounds very convinced. it's from Booth Tarkington's famous novel, 17. Remember there's a little sister in 17?
Oh.
Well, I guess that loses $57 in war bonds and stamps to Miss Ringo and a set of the Britannica, courtesy of the H.J. Hines Company, and sends us on to a question from Mrs. R. Cohen of Philadelphia. Well, what are each of the following? They are unusual words. They don't mean what they sound like. The first is creeping bent. Creeping bent, Mr. Kieran.
Creeping bent is a kind of grass that is used on golf courses in particular.
Why? Why on golf?
Because it provides a smooth lie for the ball as well as the player.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Morley, is that right?
Yes, it holds. It has a strong reticulation of.
I beg your pardon.
And prevents the sand from falling apart. It holds the sand together.
This reticulation, this new on this program, reticulation. What is reticulation?
You old gentleman,
it means
play
a
golf.
Little network.
Oh, I see. Now that is what creeping bent is. Now what is walking stick? It is not a cane. What is walking stick, Miss Thompson?
It's an insect, isn't it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
What does it look like?
Mm-hmm. Well, it goes along like that.
It's a little hard to see without television, Miss Thompson. It does go along, as you say, like that.
It doesn't go along. If you're near it, it just stands still and freezes on a twig, and it's about 2 or 3 inches long, and it's the color of a twig, and you mistake it for a twig.
Yes. Is it large enough to have a Latin name, Mr. Kieran?
It has, but I don't recall it offhand.
Oh, dreadful. Programmer, this is his first
crisis. Sticko ambulance.
Miss Thompson and gentlemen, does the phrase running title mean to you? It should mean something to every one of you for running title. Mr. Morley.
Well, it's also sometimes known as running heads. That is the title or an abbreviation of the title printed at the top of each page.
Yes, and repeated page after page. At the top of all left-hand pages, generally.
Top of the left-hand page should be the title of the book. The top of the right-hand page should be an abbreviation of the title of the chapter.
Yes.
Or the episode of that page.
That's quite right. Well, I'm afraid June is beginning to have its traditional effect on our Hines reporter. Tonight he wants to talk about love apples. We're listening, Mr. Grauer.
As a listener to this learned program, you may already know that civilized man never heard of the tomato until America was discovered. And for many years afterwards, it was called the love apple and was grown for decoration, not for food. There are conflicting stories about the first person to discover the eatability of the fruit. In Newport, you can find a memorial tablet that ascribes the honor to one Michel Feline Cornet, an artist of French extraction. Yellow newspaper clippings in Newport's Historical Society record Monsieur Cornet's impressions. The tomato, he said, grows in the sunshine. He has a fine rosy color and exquisite flavor. Well, if Monsieur Cornet found exquisite flavor in the tiny, gnarled love apples of those days, what would he say about the big, juicy, ruddy Hines Aristocrat tomatoes, which are the result of more than 50 years of scientific crossbreeding in Hines greenhouses? Half a century may seem quite a stretch of time to invest in perfecting the flavor of just one Hines ingredient, but people who use our Hines tomato ketchup, chili sauce, tomato juice, or our new condensed cream of tomato soup admit that those 50 years were indeed well spent.
Thank you, Mr. Grauer. We'll continue with a question from G. Harry Chappell of Philadelphia. What American political leaders were influenced by the following books or men? You know, the ideas that we hear about in politics don't just come out of a vacuum, do they? They come out of other men and other books. For example, Aristotle, Cicero, Locke, and Sidney all contributed to the formation of the mind of what American political leader? Aristotle, Cicero, Locke, and Sidney, all four of them helped to form his mind, Mr. Morley.
I would say Thomas Jefferson.
And you would be quite right, Thomas Jefferson. Why would you say that, Mr. Morley? Do you have any
evidence for it? Well, his ideas about representative democracy.
Yes, and those come probably from Locke.
And rationalism, and, well, I was going to use the word gallantry. It's rather old-fashioned, I suppose.
I got it another way.
A high-minded man giving themselves to the state.
I just read A Life of Thomas Jefferson.
That helps. Yes, that helps. And did you find that Mr. Jefferson acknowledged the help he got?
He certainly did.
He did, from these men of varying nationalities and times. Now, who was influenced by this group of books? The Bible, Pilgrim's Progress, and Weems's Life of Washington. Yes, Miss Thompson.
That's Abraham Lincoln.
How do we know that?
Well, I am. How do we know it? Mr. Lincoln said so.
Yes, he did. And unlike Mr. Weems, he didn't lie.
No.
There's another book that I always think of Lincoln as reading, Mr. Kieran.
No, there's another. There's a poem that he was very fond of.
What one?
Why Should the Spirit of Mortal Be Proud by Bishop Knox.
Yes, and there's still another book, very dull, that he was formed on.
No? Yes, Petroleum v. Nasby. He read Artemus Ward. He read.
Yes, he read Artemus
Ward.
But
that's not dull.
I was thinking of Blackstone's commentaries, which he.
Oh,
read,
they're not
re-read.
Dull. They're wonderful. Dull.
Are they?
Oh.
But what is your idea of a really dull book, then, Kieran? If you.
I don't read them.
I'll leave you to your Blackstone, Mr. Kieran. Jan Christian Smuts, S-M-U-T-S, and Lord Robert Cecil contributed to forming the mind of another American political leader. Who was that? This is a more recent one. Mr. Morley.
They didn't antedate him, but they had great influence on Woodrow Wilson.
They did. That's quite right. And planning for what?
Planning for the League of Nations.
That's quite right, yes. And some of the points that we find in the late lamented 14 points are derived from ideas originally devised by the South African Smuts and the English.
Smuts, in turn, was greatly
Cecil.
Influenced by Walt Whitman.
Was he really? I had
Smuts
no idea.
Smuts wrote a book
true.
That is very little known, book about Walt Whitman.
Good.
Very good.
So it's kind of a circle, Whitman to South Africa and then back again to America. Ideas have a way of traveling. That's why Mr. Hitler hasn't got a chance. Miss Ida Langdon of Elmira, New York, sends this one in. This might be called a problem in comparatives. It's a comparatively hard question, as a matter of fact. Who or what was said to be fairer than the evening air? Fairer than the evening air. Who was said to be that? That's a quotation from a famous poem, which all of you should know. You humiliate me by not knowing it. Mr. Morley.
Isn't it by Christopher Marlowe?
Yes, it is, indeed. And what is Marlowe comparing when he's talking about
something? Well, I think it's in Faustus, and I think he's speaking of Helen.
Yes, that's right. And what are the lines in which he makes that comparison? Mr. Kieran, can you give us the
topless towers of Ilium.
Well, it's in that famous passage. But he is, remember Dr. Faustus, having the vision of Helen of Troy conjured up before him, says to her, "O thou art fairer than the evening air, clad in the beauty of a thousand stars," and goes on with a number of magnificent compliments, which she was quite unable to return, as a matter of fact. Who or what was said to be deeper than the depth of water stilled at even? Mr. Kieran.
That was the Blessed Damozel Rossetti.
Yes, that's the poem that it's from. Yeah. But what actually is deeper than the depth of water stilled at even in the poem? Mr. Adams?
Her eyes.
Yes, her eyes. The Blessed Damozel looked out from the gold bar of heaven.
That's right.
And her eyes were deeper than the depth of water, stilled at even, from Rossetti's famous poem. And finally, what was said to be sweeter than heard melodies? Mr. Morley.
Keats, heard melodies are sweet, but those unheard are sweeter.
Yes, a famous line, and it's from what poem?
Oh,
Miss
I think
Thompson?
The Ode on a Grecian Urn.
Yes, the Ode to a Grecian Urn by Keats is quite right. Try this one from Mary Gall of San Dimas, California. Name two current or recent American diplomatic representatives who were military or naval men. Miss Thompson?
Admiral Stanley, for instance, who's ambassador in Russia now.
Quite right, yes. And another recent ambassador,
Mr. Adams?
Admiral Leahy.
Admiral Leahy, yes, was our ambassador to...
France.
To France, for some period, yes. Now, can you name some American diplomats? You should be able to do this for us, Miss Thompson, who were college professors.
Well, there was Ambassador Dodds, who was in Germany.
Yes, that's right. And, died a couple of years ago, did he not?
Yes.
And another?
And Ambassador Hayes, who is at the present time ambassador in Spain.
Yes, and before he held down that job, what was he?
He was professor at Columbia.
Yes, professor of...
Probably still is, on leave of absence, for all I know.
Yes, you speak with some feeling. You hope he has his job, you mean, even though he's still over. Yes, he's representing us at Spain, Carlton Hayes, the famous historian of Columbia University. Mr. Kern,
well,
going to add another?
President of Cornell University,
yes.
Was an ambassador. And there wasn't James Russell Lowell, a college man, as well as a minister to England?
He was. I don't know whether he ever was a professor. Was he, Mr. Morley? Do you know
James Russell Lowell? Yes, he was at Harvard.
James Rollin Angel's father was ambassador to Turkey.
There are a number of our diplomats who have been taken from the ranks of scholars and professors. How about two American diplomats who are women? That is, they were diplomats up to rather recently. Miss Thompson.
Well, there was Ruth Bryan, William Jennings Bryan's daughter, who was ambassador to Denmark.
Yes, it doesn't have the rank of ambassador, the rank
minister.
Below that. Minister.
And Mrs. Harriman, who was ambassador to, or minister, I've forgotten.
Yes, minister.
Let me see, Norway.
Yes. Were those the first two women diplomatic representatives we've ever had, Miss Thompson?
I don't remember any earlier ones.
I can think of no other, certainly not of ministerial rank. But it seems like a good idea. Try this one from Harry Schneiderman of New York City. Explain how each of the following phrases has come to have its present meaning. These are odd phrases that you come across from time to time. What's the origin of them? Here's the first. What's Hecuba to him? What's Hecuba to him? Mr. Kieran.
Well, that means now, what's his business in that affair, for instance?
Yes.
Of course, it's from Hamlet, speaking of the player who was so moved by his role at the first end of tears and all that sort of thing.
Yes, he was playing the role of... Who was Hecuba?
Hecuba was the wife of Priam, king of Troy.
Yes, and what are the famous lines in which Shakespeare... uses.
What's Hecuba to him, or he to Hecuba, that he should weep for her?
Yeah.
Words to that.
Yes, always full of quotations, the man Shakespeare. Now, how about this? To out-Herod, Herod. To out-Herod, Herod means what, and what's the origin of it? We see that phrase once in a while. Mr. Kieran again.
Well, that's... isn't that from the same play?
I don't think.
Is it? Well...
It is used by Shakespeare, but the origin
cruel,
of the phrase...
cruelty.
Origin is biblical.
Well, it goes back, as a matter of fact, to the miracle plays of medieval England. And Herod, whom we know from the Bible, of course, how was he represented in these miracle plays? What sort of character did he
have? He was a cruel person.
Not so much cruel, perhaps, as blustering. And what were you going to say, Miss Thompson?
Well, I was going to say a great potentate with great power and majesty.
Yes, and rather noisy.
Mm-hmm.
So that to out-Herod Herod means what?
Putting on a lot of airs.
Yes, even to the point of raving.
Mm-hmm.
You say of an actor sometimes that he out-Herods Herod, and now you simply mean that he's a ham. It's easy to say ham. How about robbing Peter to pay Paul?
You need to buy ham.
Still worried, are you, Mr. Adams? Robbing Peter to pay Paul is a phrase we use constantly. What's the origin of it, Mr. Kieran?
Oh, the origin is biblical, but the meaning of it is it's like taking money out of one pocket in order to put it into the other.
That's the meaning of it, and I thought the origin...
Phony bookkeeping.
I thought the origin was biblical, too, until I found out that it wasn't. In there are some lands belonging to St. Peter's Cathedral at Westminster. And those were sold at one time, and the money that was appropriated to repair St. Paul's, the other famous cathedral in London. This was in the time of Edward VI, and so the phrase doesn't go back as far as the Bible. To rob Peter to pay Paul means to rob St. Peter's church to pay for St. Paul's. Well, we learn something every day. That's the stump, I think, and that sends $57 in war bonds and stamps from Mr. Schneiderman and a set of the Britannica. I have a hunch that our Heinz reporter is going to try to make us, and particularly Mr. Adams, hungry again. We're at your mercy. Mr. Grauer.
When you walk into Antoine's in colorful old New Orleans and order, of course, Oysters Rockefeller, or ask for steamed lobster at Bookbinders in Philadelphia, you know you'll be served a dish that's a symphony of flavor, an epicure's dream of heaven. On such things are established the reputations of the nation's outstanding eating places. And it's this same reliability that has made Heinz 57 varieties welcome guests at American dinner tables these 74 years. For when you ask for Heinz tomato ketchup, Heinz soups, crisp pickles, or tangy mustards, you know you'll get the same dependable quality and flavor that first won you to these Keystone-labeled products. Of course, selecting the finest ingredients money can buy and preparing them with just the right combination of scientific skill and homespun care has a lot to do with this uniformity. But our vigilance goes way beyond that. We have a special quality control department whose duties are exactly what the name implies. Every one of the Heinz 57 varieties must be subjected to the most rigid continual tests imaginable before it is ready for your grocer's shelves. After all, three generations of American women have looked to us for high-quality, fine-flavored foods. That, dear ladies, is a trust we shall never take for granted and a compliment we sincerely treasure.
Thank you, Ben Grauer. How about trying this one from Helen Schaefer of Maplewood, Missouri? It's a very interesting question, I think. The answers are unusual. Name a state that since Reconstruction days has never voted Republican. One state that since Reconstruction days has never voted Republican. Miss Thompson, what
I think
you say?
South Carolina has never voted Republican since Reconstruction. When do you call Reconstruction?
Well, I should think right after the Civil War, after the ending.
No, if you said it since 1876, I don't think South Carolina.
Georgia is the only one, as far as my information goes, that has never voted Republican. That which is some sort of record. How about one that has never voted Democratic in order to keep the balance even? Is there a state that since Reconstruction days has never voted Democratic? Mr. Kieran?
I'll try Maine.
Maine is right. Mr. Adams? What were you going to say?
Maine has voted Democratic.
I think not. Can you give us the election in which it did go Democratic? You'll hear from Maine in the morning.
It elected a Democratic governor once.
Well, I meant presidential.
Oh. Yeah.
Don't split the governors on us. How about a state that since Reconstruction days voted Republican only once? Now, there are several of these. Can you name at least one? Has voted Republican only once. Mr. Adams? You had a state on the tip of your tongue. It must have been a very small state.
Texas or Missouri?
Which one do you choose?
I choose Texas.
That's right. Very good. And that's correct. North Carolina, Virginia, Texas, and Florida, who voted for Hoover in 1928. And that gives us 2 out of 3. Thank you, Dean Thompson, and thank you, Christopher Morley, for the able assistance this evening. Tonight, the H.J. Heinz Company has paid out $114 in war bonds and stamps and 2 sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Next week, information, please, following Greeley's advice, goes west. And our first stop will be Chicago. We'll broadcast on behalf of the Treasury Department from the stage of the Civic Opera House in Chicago. Our regular Kieran Levant Adams trio will be on hand. And for many years, we've been working on the editor of the Encyclopedia Britannica to be our guest and help to distribute his product more widely. We announce, gloating with glee, that we finally worn him down. And Mr. Walter Yost, the editor of the Encyclopedia Britannica, which is a Chicago institution, though still reluctant, has agreed to be on the program to uphold Chicago's fair name and give the Treasury an extra lift. Remember, send your questions and the correct answers to Information, Please, at 570 Lexington Avenue, New York City. And now, Ben Grauer.
H.J. Heinz invites you to sit in with the experts again next week at the same time. And remember that any time you can be an expert in food buying by looking for the Heinz Keystone label, your assurance of full quality in tasty, fine-flavored foods. This program came to you from New York.